I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nickturn on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/be-here-now for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn on May 28th.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
To have a different experience of yourself or of consciousness, not as a separate self, but as a feeling, a sensation of being completely integrated into the web of the universe. I mean, and so to taste that, even if you just taste it for a moment and you come back down, it sparks something.
Yeah, and exactly.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu, and for this podcast that's coming your way in a couple of minutes, I wanted to do a little bit of an introduction because this is kind of the first time I've done this before, but I did a podcast on another show. It's basically One Commune, Jeff Krosno. Some of you may remember Jeff through the Wanderlust Festival, those amazing festivals that were all around the world. He did quite a job, Jeff did. He's also got this podcast, which he had me on, and he wanted to basically talk about Ram Dass. And so for me, it became a nice opportunity to just remember Ram Dass and talk about some of my experiences with him. So I thought that would be interesting to everybody out there. I mean, some stories you may have heard, but I think they bear listening to again. And there's we had a wonderful dialogue. Jeff and I really hit it off when I first met him, which is not that long ago, maybe a year and a half ago. He's got, so the organization that he started after Wanderlust is called One Commune, and it is a video course platform with amazing people from Deepak to Russell Brand and so on. And they have courses which they offer, and you can then become a part of their membership communities. And it's all about personal and societal well-being. This is the crux of it. And he's got this beautiful place in Topanga that he invites people to, and they film them and so on. It's quite an interesting mix of people and teachers. And in a way, it has some relationship with what we do at Love, Serve, Remember, where we have retreats and we film them. And we have, of course, all this incredible Ram Dass archive from which we draw and put together courses and so on, as you're familiar with if you are on the ramdass.org mailing list, which you should be. Anyhow, he his central premise is basically a life. What he's dedicated to is a life that does not differentiate between daily life and the passion that he has, which is to share all of this wonderful content. And he did it with these festivals that really combined music and yoga and wisdom and talks from wonderful teachers. So I have the same thing. This is what I've been doing all these years, which means the most to me. By the way, I feel a lot of grace in the fact that what my passion is my daily work life. So I'm very, very fortunate. And Jeff is very fortunate. So what we're doing together, which is one of the purposes of this introduction, is we have a wonderful course that we put together that comes from basically the Be Here Now network. And it's meditations that were done with me through mind rolling with Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield and Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, all of these incredible family of teachers that we have through the network and through the retreats that we've done with Ram Dass over the years. I am really happy about so we put together this meditation course in conjunction and in partnership with one commune called Commune. And the meditations of guided meditations from Ram Dass, we cherry-picked from this incredible catalog course that we have. And then you get the bonus meditations from Jack, Sharon, Joseph, and on, So it's a very robust 10-day course, perfect for what ails us after coming into this new year, after the holidays. And so it starts on Monday, let me get this right, January 16th, and it runs for 10 days. And it's free. Everybody can join and take part if you want. We're going to, send notices about the timing and so on for one to be able to make a donation, to be able to get the material, for how long? Commune will tell you how long. That's their part in all this. We're putting it on their platform, and it's a joint venture and partnership with them. So I'm really excited about it. It's a phenomenal course. And just having Ram Dass himself guiding, and I'm sure many of you have heard, because we've put meditations out in different ways before through our courses and retreats with Ram Dass. So that is the announcement. And then, of course, you'll hear this. We had a wonderful rapport, Jeff and I. And for me, being able to sit and recount, all these moments and experiences with Ram Dass over these many years is a boon to stop my little world and my me land perspective. So here you go. This is myself on mind rolling. And Jeff is kind of, since I did the podcast on his show, he's prompting me and so on. And then I'm bringing up stuff. And as I say, it's a wonderful dialogue. So this is myself with Jeff Krasno on the One Commune podcast. And it's all pointing to this wonderful 10-day Ram Dass and Friends. Be here now, and pause. There's more to the name, but I don't remember exactly what it is. I know it's going to put a pause in your life. So go and enjoy the podcast, and look to on the show notes and everywhere else we've got going. Go to One Commune, and you'll be able to join the 10-day meditation course. Thank you.
When I'm in this kind of repartee, I've no choice. I'm all here. I'm all yours. Mm, yeah. I'm with you 100%. Yeah. And that is a great luxury, to be honest, given the attention economy that vies for your awareness moment to moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would say podcasting is a form of self-preservation for my attention span.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I like it.
Well, I'm excited to explore the life and times of the great Ram Dass with you in our conversation, and very, very thrilled for our impending collaboration to bring his teachings and the teachings of others under the aegis of the Be Here Now Network, and brings these teachings and guided meditations to the world together. Mm. So thank you for your flexibility and your enthusiasm there.
Yeah, no, I'm right with you there. I mean, I'm looking forward big time to sharing these, not just from Ram Dass, but some of our other friends, Jack Kornfield included, and others, Sharon. So yeah, this will be a very fun thing.
Yeah. So we share numerous passions and life experiences. So I know that we're both what I might call spiritual refugees of the music industry.
Yeah.
And I believe we were both radio DJs. So I was at WKCR in New York City. That was the Columbia University radio station for a good stint. And I know you were in Montreal, and I believe it was under the auspices of your role as a DJ and program director there that you first were introduced to Ram Dass. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, that was a demarcation point for me in my life, obviously, and for many, many, many people. In fact, there's such a through line for everybody about what happened when you first heard Ram Dass or you met him or whatever, yeah. The front desk called me and said, oh, there's some people want to talk to you. There's about promoting a lecture, a talk. I said, okay. So they called in and said, Ram Dass is speaking at McGill University, which is like the Harvard of Canada, pretty much. And I said, okay, except Ram Dass? What's that? Who's that? And then they immediately said, well, you know, Tim Leary and Richard Alpert. I went, oh, shit. Oh, of course. Absolutely, 100%. Love them guys. But I said, you must have a tape or something from a previous talk that he gave. So at least I have an idea of what we're talking about here. And so they sent one over to the station. I went into a studio. I put it on. And demarcation point. Okay, wow. This is what I've been kind of thinking about but couldn't put into words and feeling, that it's okay. We are not what the society and parents and family and teachers have told us we are. Mind, ego, believe your thoughts, believe your story, improve yourself and get ahead and become a somebody. And that was just extraordinarily relieving in the moment. And then I said, okay, where is it? I actually, you know what I did? I put it on the air in the middle of the day during at some point in the week. Nobody had ever heard anything like this at that point, most especially. And the switchboard just lit up. People were like, holy shit, what is this? And I, for my part, went, okay, I got to meet this guy.
And so they arranged that meeting, and that was, that got me my first real experience of, okay, you, and it's funny because you just said, you know, through the podcast, you give complete attention. If we are forced into this complete attention, right, which is a beautiful thing. That happened naturally when Ram Dass did that really to me. He didn't do anything. He just, what can I do for you without saying a word? Just created a space of nothing to do with Richard and nothing to do with Ram Dass. It only to do with me and what the universe needed to present to me in that moment. So that kind of unconditionality and a presence, that got me to India.
Mm. Amazing. Mm. Yeah, he had a way about him. And it was certainly the message as vesseled by the words, but it was also a presence to him that almost created a form of drishti or one-pointedness of mind. You know, when you're listening to him, it's almost the sounds that are as captivating as the words themselves. There was just a presence to his delivery that really brought you into this one-pointedness. It's unique, you know. Not everybody has it. I mean, yeah. Alan Watts does it for me too.
Yeah,
but
yeah, and he had it.
He had it.
How many of us, especially coming up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s even, it's Alan Watts and Ram Dass is your first entry point. And what you're saying is so absolutely true, and we know it even more readily from being around music and having that as part of our vocation, how powerful sound is. And, you know, there's Tibetan Buddhists, monks, that use a sound directive that is a siddhi of some sort, able to stop people in their tracks or completely change an emotion over. I mean, it's definitely a thing, for sure.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny that you bring up the parallel with music. And clearly one of the best ways to begin meditating is just to shut up and listen for a moment. But there are all these, I wouldn't call them gimmicks, but like tricks in some ways to help us find that single-pointedness, you know, whether you're using Tibetan bowls or mantra, or just as I'm sure you've experienced thousands of times. I think one of the reasons why so many of us in the music industry end up making this taking this off ramp is because we know the experience of connecting with the foundational reality of something and not the symbol of it. And that's what music can so often be. It is just dong. It is the thing. Yeah. You know, it's not
the original
a word
vibe
that we've given it.
The yeah. original vibration. Krishna says something that's says it very directly and simply. Because what he does, and for those of you who don't know, he's one of the foremost kirtan or chant singers in this side of the world and in India. He's now being asked to go to India. He's like, bring it back from America. But he would say, so these are mantras that take us into that one point and beyond into the connection to the intuitive reality, which is the love or whatever we want to call it. And the music, and especially with what he's doing, because, you know, he grew up as a Westerner and he was in a rock and roll band, and so chord changes are very familiar, you know, to people. And it's the music that the mantra rides on top of it, and basically the medicine goes down a hell of a lot easier with that music.
Yeah. Yeah, I got the opportunity to develop a bit of a relationship with Herbie Hancock. I was on tour with him here and there for a summer. And he is a Buddhist. I think he's a Nichiren.
Yes, he is.
And he would have a ritual before going on stage every night. And he would chant the Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. Now, I had never heard mantra before, but I was pretty into Herbie Hancock. And there I was as a pretty young man being in his backstage. And then he would have sort of an inner sanctum, kind of the backstage behind the backstage, where he would then gather for about 10 minutes before showtime. And he would invite anyone that was interested to chant with him. But you'd have to stay the whole time. You couldn't, you know, pop in and out. And I remember we were at Carnegie Hall, actually, and they run a tight union ship at Carnegie Hall. And he was in the back chanting. And you could tell that there was a little uneasiness because he was supposed to hit the stage right at 8, and here it was 8:01, and he was still chanting in the back. But even I can't really remember what the literal Sanskrit translation is to Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, something about the lotus flower, something. But you actually don't really connect with the meaning of the words anymore. It's actually just bringing you in to the present through sound, right?
Yeah, well, they all have a very particular vibration that I mean, like Indian music, for instance, all the ragas, they all have some relationship to a time of day, to a mood, to a spiritual expression. So, yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, of course, these people in the East are so highly developed. I mean, look at the Tibetans and that extraordinary philosophy. That, I mean, I particularly am enamored with it because it just sings to me in terms of, okay, this makes sense. This, their perspective of reality and the truth. And the Indians have definitely developed that over, obviously, thousands of years.
Yeah. So can you timestamp that experience that you had meeting Ram Dass and discovering that you didn't have to wear the spacesuit all the time?
You want me to timestamp?
Well, just more or less, give me a year.
It's 69, 70 is when I met him.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
in the winter.
He was post, kind of psychedelia at that juncture.
So just a fast track thing on what happened with him, and people do know that he was thrown out of Harvard, he and Leary, for the experimentation with drugs, which is now happening big time with ethnogens. It was really a kind of an uptight situation. Anyhow, but for him, I mean, they did things like, I was really fortunate, Jeff, because I ended up in this place, Kosani. It was just me and Krishnadas and a couple other people in Ram Dass. We were waiting for a Buddhist meditation teacher to come and teach meditation. He ended up not being able to come, and where ensued, we were doing a self-directed thing, Ram Dass being more or less the teacher. And it was just extraordinary because at night he would regale us with stories of those days at Millbrook and so on, and Harvard. And one thing they did, for instance, let's go into a room, a small room, Leary and Alpert and a couple of the other people that were around. We're not going to leave the room for 7 days. We are going to take with us as much psychedelics as you could hold in a suitcase, and we're just going to ingest. They did this for a week. Who would do this? This is kind of psychonaut from, like, what? And Ram Dass, so he would regale us with these stories. So it was really, you know, quite unbelievable. But the thing is that he realized at that point, I keep coming down. Keep coming down. I mean, it gives a beautiful glimpse, seems to, but keep coming down. And he said, so he met up with his David Padua, a friend of his who was going to, off to India and then Japan, and they were just going to do this tour, and they were into Buddhism, basically. And the rest is of course, history. But what Ram Dass was looking for was to find that map of consciousness. And that's why he went, and he left. He never really left psychedelics behind. Obviously, later in his life, he maybe occasionally he would do some mushrooms or something. But he then, of course, met Neem Karoli Baba and realized what that map was. And then he came back and translated that map to young Westerners like ourselves, myself. And that was the point at which I met him. He had been doing that for a couple of years, and I met him at that point, actually, and it was maybe from the point I met him till him going back to India, which is why, oh, you're going to India again? Okay, I got to go there. Well, I can't tell you. He says, I can't tell you the name of the person or where he is. I said, I don't care, I'm coming. And Krishnadas, of course, went further and really forced them to give him a name of somebody in a town nearby, and they ended up going a few months earlier than I did. And so that, when he came back, those talks are extraordinary talks, and those are the first talks that we started the Be Here Now Network with. Ram Dass Be Here Now Network, and with those talks, and I introduced them, and I told pretty much this story that I'm relating right now.
Yeah, in fact, I really encourage all listeners, if they want to go on a deep dive, to go and visit the Here and Now podcast, because I've been actually spending a bunch of time in there. It's so much fun. And downloading many of the early stories of and the early lectures, which are fascinating. And Ram Dass has a certain awareness of his own story and his own journey that he tells, which is wonderful. And of course, he does it in such an eloquent, poetic way. But It to listen to his story does really bring it into sort of a real stark relief, because he was on the path to being essentially a very, very highly respected tenured Harvard professor, essentially. I mean, and he could have very easily stayed on that path. I mean, he had gotten his PhD from Stanford in psychology, which I know that because my dad also got a PhD in Stanford in psychology. They weren't there quite at the same time, but pretty close. And at that point, him being Richard Alpert, he was really fast tracking to a very illustrious place in academia. And he certainly was enjoying some of the spoils of that. And I think he mentioned he had a Cessna.
Yeah, he had a Cessna and a Harley.
But he quickly grew tired of both of them, it sounded like.
Well, it's hard, when you fly the Cessna by yourself on acid, it can be a little bit.
I was wondering, actually, when I heard that, if that had ever happened, or if you, oh man, Jesus. Okay. And then you and I assume that a lot of people know these stories, but certainly not everybody does. At Harvard, I think Harvard had also kind of in that early 60s recruited Timothy Leary, and that's where they met and began a lot of the psychedelic escapades that I think really kind of bent that first chapter of his life. And you mentioned, it wasn't just psilocybin, but it was also peyote and DMT and LSD and all of the requisites. But, it's interesting, particularly as things have come full circle around psychedelics, and there's a lot of debate around it now, But to what degree do you feel that psychedelics were essential to his journey and potentially yours, even though they might not have represented the ultimate answer?
Yeah. Well, Ram Dass himself said this, and I would have seconded it, said it myself. I think we all, there was only a couple of hundred Westerners that actually made it over to India, 200-300 tops, if you can think of what that relates to, you know, these incredible beings that, you know, that we know of these days. So thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of acolytes and so on. He said, I wouldn't have gotten Neem Karoli Baba. I wouldn't have gotten it without psychedelics.
Hmm.
And now, did everyone and their mother take acid before they went to India? Probably not. A greater proportion? Yeah. Yeah, I would say a great proportion. And it made that experience. Well, it's like experiencing a thing, not someone like we're relating back and forth. There was no us and them with this being, and it was so odd and so counterintuitive to what we had been, the way that we had been brought up, the devotion to the rational mind and you know, the exchange that we have with everybody. You know, it's conditional. And to actually, oh my God, this is not happening at all. So the idea that with psychedelics, and by the way, Ram Dass throughout his life, I mean, from the very beginning, you know, from the very beginning, he would say it's about set and setting and respect, you know, just having the correct preparation, which is what they're doing now with the psychedelic therapy. They're following that road, basically. And so he was insistent on that. When anybody would ask him, Ram Dass, do you think it would be good for me to do some mushrooms or something? And he would go right to that place of respect and making sure that you really plan this in set and setting, meaning, you know, who and what you're with and what music you play, and you know, and supremely important. And so he would say that all the way through. But in
the Cessna notwithstanding,
the Cessna notwithstanding. Yeah, see, people listen to, you know, like if oh God, yes. And all through his life, so. You just said, well, he was at Harvard. He had everything. I mean, he was an esteemed professor. I mean, he was really thriving. Why did he, you know, do what he did, and to the disadvantage of his career, so to speak? Well, he did it because he was so adventurous and so curious. Curious is probably the best word. And once he got introduced to entheogens and mushrooms in the beginning, so he had the idea, okay, there is something that is absolutely beyond our rational, the way that we think, the story we believe, the thoughts that we believe, there is something beyond that. So once that happened, it didn't matter. Harvard, no Harvard, he wanted to get at the truth. And he had such a, you know, this is one being that had a deep, deep commitment to getting at that truth. And then alongside of that, Jeff, it was a commitment to share it. That's the greatest aspect of Ram Dass, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I think curious is the word. I mean, certainly he was well-versed enough in Freudian psychology and cognitive behavioral therapy and all of the different kinds of therapies. But in the end, he felt that these fell short to really, truly explain the human condition and the human experience. And so it was this journey. And And yeah, I think, you know, just to speak to my own experience with psychedelics, which certainly isn't, I can't hold a candle to Ram Dass. I think he mentioned that he tripped maybe 300 times or so. But even, but that might be the understatement of the year. But, you know, even in my own experiences, to glimpse the possibility of experiencing consciousness, not as a separate self or as an ego self or all of the different labels that one gives oneself in relation to society, culture, etc., to have a different experience of yourself or of consciousness, not as a separate self, but as a feeling, a sensation of being completely integrated into the web of the universe. I mean, and so to taste that, even if you just taste it for a moment and you come back down, it sparks something.
Yeah.
And
Exactly. And the problem that can ensue is it's an incredible experience. And you want that experience over and over. And then, you know, people around ayahuasca particularly, you know, they feel like things get revealed on successive journeys. And so, which I'm sure is true, but there also is a truth around the inevitability of attachment to the experience, and that creates other issues.
Absolutely. And you can also say that is true for meditation as well. I mean, a lot of people are adopting a meditation practice for all of these so-called future benefits that it may yield, right? It's like, oh, well, I'll perform more optimally, or I'll grow more gray matter.
Say mindfulness, same thing. You know, I'll be a better stockbroker. Yeah,
I'll make that's more right. I'll lower my cortisol levels. Yeah. And all of that stuff is true.
Yeah.
But to pursue a meditation or mindfulness practice for those goals, you know, you lose the point.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I got to give you a quote. It's just popped up. We just, for Love, Serve, Remember Foundation, just did a film, and it's been out in theaters and so on, and it's online. And it's the story of a man named K.C. Tiwari, who was Krishnadas and I and others. Major mentor back in those days in India. And so he would go, it's called The Brilliant Disguise, because he was a regular man, taught at school, was a headmaster of a boys' school, had a family, the whole nine yards. The Samadhi of K.C. Tiwari. So Samadhi is just loosely, because it's a profound word, you know, deep absorption through meditation. So he used to go into these states around Neem Karoli Baba and around us. I mean, in the film, I went on a little journey with my mother to India, and he was with us. And he at one point said, you know, you can't leave your religion behind and just adopt an Eastern religion. You know, you can't just do that. You're Jewish? I said, yeah. And he said, well, do you know a prayer? Could you repeat a prayer in Hebrew? And my mother and I looked at each other, and as I say in the film, she wasn't a big follower of, she was, you know, Jews that are more
cultural
Jews, not the religious Jews. Anyhow, we sang Enke Eloheinu, which means there is nothing but God. This is the only one. Enke Eloheinu. We went on, yeah, boom. He's in Samadhi. My mother, never seen anything like this. No pulse, no breath. And like a stone. And I said, it'll be okay, because I was used to it by that time. I knew that eventually. And he came back down and all. So he, I had never seen anything like this. I met around Maharaji, there was two or three people that he would just look at them, bong, they were gone, and he'd say, what happened to them? You know, he'd have fun with us around it. But I had never seen anything like this in my life. And then at one point in this film, he says, and this is loosely translated. Meditation isn't about concentration. Meditation is not a business. It's not a way to go from here to there. Meditation is part of your life. Meditation is a lifestyle. And I thought it was so great, because we in the West have such an issue, as you just said, about how we're going to do something and we're going to get something. You know, that's what we're based on. And making it a fabric of our life is really what it's about.
Yes. Well, we're living within an epistemological structure that sanctifies product over process. And it's built into kind of Abrahamic thought. I mean, man was fashioned out of a ceramic figurine as matter, and then animated through God's breath into his nostril. And, you know, that has followed us for, you know, millennia, this idea that we are somehow a thing, a product made of stuff. And and usually very dumb stuff. I think, you know, the religions of the East have always seen the universe as process, as emergent, as spontaneous, as mutually interdependent. So those of us in the West, to really connect with presence, which is really process, it requires us to divorce ourselves, to cleave ourselves in many ways from sort of the cultural hegemony of this sanctification of endless, like, product. Like, what are you going to make of yourself? Literally. And then when you have a moment of satori and you say, no, I'm just completely here now, impermanent, in constant flux. It's a great relief, to be honest, because you release yourself from all of those expectations, you know, that society thrusts upon you.
Yeah, Bob Dylan saved me, by the way, on that one. I was 15 or whatever it was. Yes.
So I wanted to talk about Neem Karoli Baba for a moment. So obviously, you know, Ram Dass and Leary and, you know, everyone was experimenting with psychedelics, and then, you know, realized that, oh, wait a minute, these guys in the East have been talking about this kind of experience for 2,500, 3,000 years, or even farther back. And I think Leary, that I got this from your, I think from your podcast, but Leary actually tried to adapt the Tibetan Book of the Dead into a guidebook for psychedelics, which I thought was fascinating.
Oh, that's a famous book, that Leary and Alpert and Metzner put together. They were introduced by Aldous Huxley to the original, Tibetan Book of the Dead.
But then, as you mentioned, as psychedelics, as the effect of it wore off, you and Bhagavan Das and Richard at that juncture embarked on trips to India to find a potential guru. So what was that experience like? And And how did one, how did everyone connect with Neem Karoli Baba, and what were some of the beliefs and belief structures that Karoli Baba held that were so enchanting?
That's a big one.
Yeah.
Big one.
Take it and bite.
Take it and bite. First of all, he didn't expose. He did expose the truth, but it was not through any kind of philosophy or anything except one thing. He'd point his finger and go, in Hindi, sub ek, there is only one. Christ, Hanuman, Buddha, Muhammad, one, there's a one. And then that was the very, very first thing that we heard from him in that moment that we first met him. It was only one. So that's the only, love, as Ram Dass said, well, this foundation is called Love, Serve, Remember. And Ram Dass would say, the only instructions I had from my guru, love everyone, serve everyone, and remember God, period. And tell the truth. He added that one on the end. So, and really we got there because of Ram Dass. Now, he was introduced by Bhagavan Das, but it was Ram Dass who Maharaji said, we called him Maharaji, for those of you who don't know, just it's a common name for a holy being. Babaji or Maharaji, they're all, which is good. You don't have to remember anybody's name. In fact, you don't have to remember, and Ma, all women are Ma. It's so great, especially now. Anyhow, we, even Neem Karoli Baba said to us at one point, none of you would have gotten here except for Ram Dass. And so, yes, was there people who did get there who had not heard of Ram Dass? Yes, I'm sure there were, but they were, there were many fewer of them. Ram Dass, because of him going around and lecturing, and we bugged him. Now, some people, because he would say, I can't tell you who he is or what his name is. And so I wasn't going over there looking for a guru. I was interested in Eastern stuff before I met Ram Dass. I'd heard, you know, through Allen Ginsberg. I love Allen now. And he brought chanting. He's the first person I heard doing, you know, he'd have that crazy little harmonium and he'd be chanting Hare Krishna, you know, in, on the east, lower east side. And he was the one who said, marijuana is a good thing. It's a good, good medicine. That, oh, good. I trusted Alan, you know, this is at 14 years old, whatever. And I didn't actually find any till later because it wasn't ubiquitous in any way. So anyhow, but there were those of us that said, okay, we can't go. And they stayed home, even though they knew about this being was there somewhere in India. And there were those of us, Ram Dass, please, I got to know. I got to go. And those of us that did that, I mean, Krishnas, he finally, oh, this is a good story. Krishnas and another friend, Ramesh Radas, who wrote this great, with Ram Dass, Being Ram Dass, the memoir, just came out a couple of years ago. And Danny Goleman, who also wrote a phenomenal book named Emotional Intelligence, which is required reading for most people to this day. They said, well, Ram, they bugged him really badly. And then finally he said, all right, you can write to this man in this town that's nearby where I stayed at the ashram when I first went. And they did. His name was K.K. Shah, who became Ram Dass's close, close Indian brother. He died literally a month after Ram Dass. And he said, I'm not staying without Ram Dass. So that's how close they were. Anyhow, they wrote to him. He went to Maharaj. He said, look, this some Ram Dass's students have written you, Maharaji, and they want to come see you. And he went, what? Who cares? What do I have to do with anybody? And then KK went, and he pouted. KK had an exceptional relationship. He knew him since he was 6 years old, 8 years old. And Maharaji popped him on the head and said, "What's up? What's up? You know, what are you moaning about?" He said, "Well, these students have respectfully written to you and they want to come and so on, and they're Ram Dasses." And he said, "Look, do whatever you want." So he wrote back to Krishna Das and said, not so many words, "Well, Maharaji is available to anybody at any time." And, you know, he made it sound like it was perfectly fine for them to come over, even though they weren't getting any kind of special invite. So they did go, not knowing that. They didn't find out till years later what Maharaji really said. "What do I have to do with anything? Jow, go." And so they went over. And in my case, he just said, "Write to me when I'm in India." And I wrote to him. As soon as I did, Maharaji couldn't be found at that moment. And we actually met, Ram Dass and I, for the first time in India after I had arrived. He'd been there 4 or 5 months, and I maybe several. And we met at Swami Muktananda's ashram near Mumbai. You know who Swami Muktananda is, I think. Yeah. So I had this meeting with Ram Dass, and then he, boom, sent me up, and that was it. So other people found it at that point because it became known Ram Dass was in India, and he'd be at the hotel, and people would come over, "Ram Dass, where?" You know, it'd be really helter-skelter like that. And then doing a meditation course in Bodh Gaya, where many people met Ram Dass or knew about him and then went on with him. And many people knew of it because of Ram Dass used to hold these amazing summer retreats at his father's farm in New Hampshire. And we'd all get together. It was just yoga, chanting. It's in the movie. It's actually in the movie of Becoming Nobody a little bit, and which there's a beautiful film that we have of that complete experience. So people knew, and those who were a little bit more, shall we say, aggressively wanting to meet somebody like Ram Dass described in his talks, they got over there.
Yeah. I mean, these days, it's hard to separate these guru figures from their various peccadillos and sexual transgressions, etc. We often hear about gurus whose behavior is not in alignment with their highest principles, let's say.
They're not cooked. But those are not... The guru is a shitty word, because there's the Coke guru, there's the cleaning lady guru. I mean, there's gurus everywhere. That has nothing to do with an actual being. There are beings that are called in India siddhas. They have gone beyond me and you. They are no longer polarized whatsoever. And the KKR friend used to say, for every 10,000 saints that are gurus that are walking around India, there's, like 10 siddhas, you know. So there is a huge difference between someone who's completely cooked and someone who's not. And the ones that are not act out in ways that we are pretty used to here in America, especially, or in the West, right? It's such a common thing. And it's just unfortunate in the way that how we relate with figures like this is a little askew. Again, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, probably says it best, because there have been Tibetan lamas recently that has been the case as well. And he says, you know, just it's your experience, not what someone tells you to do or not do. It's your inner experience. So it's trust. For me, what I relate to people is intuitive trust is a huge thing. Huge. And to get there, you've got to do a little bit of practice to open up that door.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think the utility of the siddha is in terms of providing some form of conveyance, let's say, from the feeling of separateness to the feeling of samadhi? I mean, what's the utility of a siddha in this?
Well, I mean, I only knew, well, I knew, of course, Maharaji. I knew Ananda Mahima, who's a great woman, exemplar of no more than me and you, and some of the great Tibetans I have been fortunate to meet. You see the potential of us as humans. I mean, I'll put it into the most common, grounded language. We start to, once you see this, and you can do, you can no longer move in that polarized, separated self in this world without any kind of wisdom, the wisdom of being kind, compassionate, the wisdom of seeing your motivations, which is why mindfulness is such, you know, is an important practice, absolutely. Seeing our motivations, you no longer can walk that walk anymore. So they actually instill this, you know, the ones that are cooked, completely cooked, they instill this by virtue of their own example. And then of course, you know, Ram Dass used to talk about the miraculous things that Neem Karoli Baba did all the time, and he was caught by them. And when he came back to India the second time, he realized, wait, it's not about that. It's about love. It's about that unconditionality. It's about kindness. It's about compassion. It's about serving people. It's about feeding people. Getting to the point where you can tell the truth because you're not living in fear. So that is they are exemplars of what we can be. And we don't have to be, you know, completely enlightened where, yes, you know, now you're able to perform magic tricks. It's nothing about that. It's just about the truth of, as Ram Dass has said himself, when is it enough what you need? When is it enough what you want, of what you want? It's much more interesting to serve.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, in those moments where we feel that all of our needs are met, then love really becomes something given and not something taken. And we really need to access the present moment in order to grok that sensation. Because if you are always looking into the future with this mindset of if only and only if I achieve that or get this thing or add this thing to my pile, then I'll be happy. Then I'll be content. Yeah. But of course, you know, where that ends
There's
up.
There's no end to that one, yeah.
That's the old hedonic treadmill. Yeah. So you know, I've heard Ram Dass in various different lectures talk about bhakti yoga, talk about Ashtanga yoga, and some of these obviously are somewhat interchangeable, but if there was a particular methodology, how would you, to Ram Dass's teachings, how would you describe it?
Hmm. Well, certainly bhakti yoga is the yoga of love. But you know what? The lineage, which comes from Neem Karoli Baba to Ram Dass to others, you know, through all of us at one point or another. The interesting thing is, from the very get-go, we get to India. Somehow Ram Dass finds out about a Vipassana insight meditation course in Bodh Gaya. And I think you're familiar with that. Very much so, because I know you work with Jack. Suddenly, there's a huge, the influx of people, the huge influx of people, which is, you know, hundreds of people. It seemed huge at the time. We'd go to these courses. And Maharaji would say, he'd say in Hindi, "Tum jana hai, you're going to," and in English you go, "Course? You want to do the course?" It seemed like a way to get rid of us. Because he always seemed to be trying to get rid of us. You know, these young hippies hanging out. What the hell? You know, and more of them all the time. And then we come back from the course. I remember one time we came back from the course, and he's sitting outside a house that we were going to visit him at, and with some Indian people. And, "You just came back from the course." This is all through a translator. And, yeah. He said, "Well, you know how to meditate now?" And we go, "Yeah." He said, "Well, show me." And so we all sat up straight to meditate. Within 10 seconds, this high-pitched laugh that he had, "Hey, look, they know how to meditate." But the truth was that we all seemed to gravitate towards Buddhist teachings, all the way from the Hinayana, where the insight meditation comes from Burma, all the way to Tibet. And, you know, to this day, Danny Goleman, who is, you know, an esteemed writer and is close to the Dalai Lama, right? I know, you know, we all have taken teachings from different Tibetans over the years. In fact, one of the miraculous things that happened that Maharaji did, knowing everything, I had to go to Delhi to get my passport renewed, Canadian, because I'm Canadian, and my former radio boss said, "Well, if you have any trouble at all, go to the Canadian High Commissioner," James George is his name. And I came from Kosani, and I'm coming through. I stopped by where Neem Karoli Baba was, and we had this whole conversation. But he basically said, "You just have darshan of a Tibetan Lama?" I go, "No, I don't know any. I never met a Tibetan in my entire life." "You mean this Buddhist meditation?" He said, "Nay. Tibet Lama, he gave you darshan, he gave you teachings for half an hour." I go, "No, Maharaji, I don't know." "Jow." Off I went to Delhi to get my passport renewed. And I said to James George at one point, "Is it true that Canada is letting in Tibetan refugees?" Because I had heard this. He said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact," and he points, out of a room, a den, comes a retinue of monks with a lama named Kalu Rinpoche, one of the great lamas of the last century. I just, you know, I plutzed, as they say in Yiddish. I hit the floor. First of all, it was meeting this incredible lama, and then knowing, holy shit, he knows that? This isn't some thought I had. This is something that was going to happen like 3 days later, or a week later, 3 days later. And then they went to interview this lama. There was a couple of Canadian CBC guys, and they went in and they said, "Oh, come along." So I went in, and they asked him stuff like about Christianity. And he said, "I don't know anything about Christianity." He was bored with them. He obviously didn't want to engage with them. And they said to me, "Well, why don't you ask him a question?" As soon as they said that to me, he sat upright and lasered me like... And then I spilled out stuff about meditation and how I can meditate in the mountains, but now I'm in the city. I can't handle it. And he gave me all these teachings for a half an hour. So from that point, and this happened to many of us, the retreats, for instance, that we have done when Ram Dass started living in Maui, which was 2004, 2005. And then we started running retreats because we knew he couldn't go anywhere, so we organized them to be there a couple of times a year, these fairly large retreats. Every one of them, Jeff, had a Buddhist component to it. Jack has been primary there, but Roshi Joan Halifax, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, you name it. And that has been primary for us because there is the lineage that is represented by us all, and certainly by Ram Dass, is bhakti yoga and discriminating wisdom. It's that and primarily from Buddhist thought. And that combination has, you know, well, we just came back from one 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago. Same thing with Jack and Trudy and Krishnadas and a bunch of other incredible people. And it's that joining of these two traditions that I think is, I think it's marvelous. Marvelous.
Yeah, well, this kind of syncretism between, well, certainly between like Taoism and Buddhism that more or less birthed Zen. I mean, you see these traditions that have share a common substrate, and then they find the more kind of cultural elements, or, you know, we begin to disentangle them and re-entangle them, and I think that that's part of, that's kind of baked into Buddhism, is this notion that it's, there's no final word of God, you know, it's evolving within the Sangha, right? And that's what makes it so dynamic and wonderful. It's just that you and I right here in this conversation, we could have some, we could land on some moment of Satori that pushes the paradigm or the conversation forward or to the side or in different ways. And I think that that's the fact that it's something that is alive is
super important, for sure. Yeah. For sure. It has to be, because as we know, the byword is impermanence, and that, and it's not a bad word, it's a good word, you know. Just think of, you know, when you get ill, and maybe, you know, I don't mean devastating ill, but even a headache, you can sit with it and know it is not going to stay the same no matter what. And it is, so that so impermanence in this way, it fits in with the idea of being curious and seeing how things fit together. And you know, many people have different ways to get on the path and different introductions, and it takes them from one place to another, and there's constant change, which is really, really important. I would say, though, about bhakti can get a really bad name in that, well, I'll give you an example. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, one of the great lamas translating the Tibetan Buddhisms that exists out there. These books are just extraordinary, his books. When we first met him, which was with Ram Dass, we had just come back from India, you know, the second time in the 70s, and we would go down and see him, and he'd say, "Oh, Ram Dass is here, and his light and love army." We were the light and lovers. And, you know, he would jive us about, you know, the Indian hippie bhakti yoga-ish, you know, yoga doing, you know, young people. And so we had fun with that, with him. And the truth was, we were there because we were really just absorbing this incredible wisdom and applying it and it merging it with the yoga of the heart. And I know, and Ram Dass used to say something that I, you know, definitely agree with. Especially the Tibetan view of the truth, shall we say, is so crystalline and so, they call it Vajra, cutting through so much. It's extraordinary. I mean, I've been captured by it. And it is easy to get captured by it mentally. And then you do, to me, you do one of two, there's two possibilities. One is you are doing that famous thing of like taking all this beautiful information and avoiding anything in terms of your personal, your psychology, your, you know, your habitual patterns, your neurotic tendencies, and doing the end run, right? Spiritual bypass. And the other thing is to just absolutely ignore the heart process, which can be very difficult and painful, right? Because it brings up everything, all of our interrelationships. When we open our hearts, we say chanting, you know, going to a Krishnadas concert, whatever, you know, it opens us up to stuff that is not sometimes pretty, because it's a lot of emotional baggage is laying deep, deep recesses of our being. So it can have that. And Ram Dass used to make fun of them, make fun of the Buddhists in that way, you know, just saying, you know, this is a giant trap, a gigantic trap. And we'd have that dialogue with Jack and, you know, and others all the time.
Yeah, well, the irony here is that there is a temptation the moment that you embark on the path of liberation to crave not to crave, which yeah. is a clinging in and of itself.
Yes.
So this is the
good
so
one. No, that could be a, you know, maybe we'll give that one up at the end. I don't know.
Right, right. But it is, because we're so conditioned to analyze everything rationally and empirically,
yeah.
That it, you know, it's very tantalizing to practice bhakti yoga just for the intellectual intrigue of it, you know.
Well, it gets you
or Buddhism, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the beauty of bhakti. So that's a difficult thing. I mean, we're actually going to do we're doing this wonderful course with Commune with you guys. We haven't even said anything about it. That's a wonderful, we mentioned the meditation course with Ram Dass and friends that Jeff will talk about in a minute, I'm sure. But we're doing something around the yoga of the heart, a course. And we're going to investigate with people just some of the promises and pitfalls, as he used to call it, that come with that particular practice, because there certainly is. And that's why discriminating wisdom is extremely important ingredient.
Mm. Yeah. I think there's like this fine line of delineation between faith, which could be categorized as sort of belief in the absence of evidence, and devotion, which is really more a kind of a trust in a way. I've personally had sort of a tricky time, sort of like a minefield, discriminating between those things, because, you know, I am empirically minded to some degree. I love medical science, and I love physiology, and I love environmental science and life sciences in general. And I am interested in dissecting how things are and how things work. Yet at the same time, that can provide a great blockage into what might be called intuitive wisdom, you know? And finding that delicate, that sensitive balance between the two of them.
Absolutely. Well put, Jeff. I mean, that is, especially for Westerners, especially difficult. We are so attached to the belief of the power of our minds, you know. And that's really, you asked earlier, yeah, well, so kind of what is the effect of a Neem Karoli Baba? He shattered that. I mean, that's what happened. I mean, that is probably the biggest thing. He shattered our minds. We could no longer depend on that empirical rationalization of who we are in this world. That was gone. Even if we hadn't embodied the potential of that intuitive wisdom. But we were well on the path. You know, and it's been a lifetime here in terms of when I look back of the progression of it. It's pretty interesting. And thank God. That's all I got to say.
Yeah. You know, love was such a central theme and central word to Ram Dass's life and being. And I wonder if you could unpack how you've come to understand that word or that symbol, I suppose, because there's a lot of different ways to potentially understand it.
Yeah. Well, it's another, we have really wrecked so many words in the English language at this point.
Yeah.
We talked about guru, you know, it's just like surrender. There's when Ram Dass first came back and he started telling his story of being in India, meeting Maharaji and all, and practicing yoga, he would say, well, I know there's a few things here that are really tough for me to even mention. Guru, surrender, love. It's really, oh my God, look what's happened, you know. Well, I think the word, we're used to conditional love, transactional love. I mean, that's, you know, maybe, you know, like when I was telling you the story of first meeting Ram Dass at that time in Montreal, and he created an unconditional zone, and I thought to myself later, well, I potentially experienced that with my mother, with a mother, right, that is feeding you. There's an unconditionality and caring for you as a baby. But I couldn't really remember that, and this was the first, it quickly went downhill for me after that. When this was the first moment, when I met him, early 20s, whatever. This was a moment that was so profound that, wow, there's actually a field here, a vibrational field here that I feel the unconditionality of this love. And I think so to properly define love is to include the word unconditional and being love. And this was a big thing for Ram Dass, being love. You're not doing anything. You're not, you know, we experienced that with Neem Karoli Baba. You knew that there wasn't someone deciding to throw an apple to a person as an expression of love or grace or whatever. It was just happening. We knew that. So we had that. We had something to look to in relation to I'm saying this now. Of course, I wasn't thinking this then. To redefining what love really means. You know, and you know who's gone along? His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, has done so much for us. My only religion is kindness, he would say. Right? We have to develop compassionate mothers. It's all about women who come up and are having children, and they have a compassion the way my mother, speaking His Holiness, had this giant compassion. He said, that's why I am who I am now. It was literally passed on. That's what our hope for the future is compassionate mothers, and then children, and then from generation to generation. That is our hope for the future. So I think, you know, redefining love, faith, for instance. You know, Sharon Salzberg has a great, Wise Faith. You know, it's a book called Faith, but it's really Wise Faith. And that's really, so I think that, again, that's discriminating wisdom with love.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's love, at least in the West, gets lumped in to the taxonomy of emotions. You know, so it's like, okay, well, there's some sort of biochemically produced sensation in me arising, and now it's subsiding, and there it goes. You know, you know, when I hear Ram Dass talk about love, it's awareness beyond the ego, essentially. It's a state of being, really, that you align with or that you visit. It doesn't really visit you. It's, I suppose, kind of like Colorado in that sense, although you don't have to get on an airplane, it's always in you. And I think, you know, the words that you brought up, like unconditional, when you think of like metta, for example, the bringing forth of loving kindness unconditionally, or karuna, the identification of someone else's suffering as your own, or mudita, the experience of joy only for somebody else's joy. I mean, how wonderful is that? You know, so these are the signatures of love. You know, in this day and age, I often think of providing someone with my absolute undivided attention is an act of love. And particularly in, like, you know, the era of distraction that we're living in. And that's not disconnected from upekkha, like this idea of equanimity, which often kind of sort of gets categorized as, you know, passivity or conciliation or whatever, but not, that's not, I think that's an improper understanding of it. I mean, for me, it's bringing your full self, your full-throated, energetic, passionate self to this moment with you, Raghu, right here, right now, without any attachment to the result of what this might be. Exactly. I'm just here with you. And if we could all just do that for each other, my God, you know, we would bend the arc.
Unfortunately, antiethical to the way we grew up and the installation of the belief systems in the empiricalness of it all. You know, so it makes it a little bit, which is, again, got to do practice to create a spaciousness that allows you to see the reality of how we are clinging. Joseph Goldstein, who, by the way, anybody who hasn't heard of Joseph, like, get on with it.
Has to get hip immediately.
Oh, God, yeah. And he wrote a book called Mindfulness, which is just phenomenal. But he was when he was with us in Maui one year, he was with a young person who had just gotten on the path, who was assigned to drive him around. And that person said, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. You've been on the path. Can you just give me what's your major piece of advice, okay, that you could give me? And he turned to him and he went, stop clinging. And you see how everything is that. And if and clinging is one thing, but resisting and pushing away is part of clinging, because you're clinging to be in a more comfortable moment, for instance. And we have such a hard time with that, and we have such a hard time with discomfort and making friends with discomfort. I mean, it's just going to India, and I did everything, you know, me, as Jack would say, it's okay to be human. And I found the places that were going to have the best food and the most comfortable accommodations. In India, that's not really possible all the time, or if any of, you know, barely much of the time. And, you know, and I just watched how I do that. And we are all doing that. And that's where mindfulness comes in, because you can get some, and meditation, to create enough space, as I said before, for us to be able to walk more lightly around these day-to-day life issues.
Yeah. I mean, parenthood is a place where clinging comes up, you know, on the regular. And I mentioned to you before we started that my eldest daughter has relocated some 6,000 miles away from me, anyways, to in Paris. And that process of letting go, of not clinging, you know, I could intellectually think through it, but the moment that I had to take her to the airport and say, you know, this is it. After 18 years of raising you, you're not sleeping at home tonight or tomorrow night or the next night, you know, or whatever. And I don't want to dramatize it too much because she'll be back next week for Christmas. But nevertheless, it spurred on some meditation around clinging and, nirvana literally translates as blowing out, right? So if you think of like your breath, the most certain way to die is to cling to your breath, right? You know, the only way it comes back to you is if you don't cling to it. You just have to, let it go. Mm-hmm. And I'm praying the same is true with daughters. but yeah. these are lessons that, we hopefully pick up. We hopefully pick up along the way.
Yeah. We will. We do. It's a matter of a little bit of trust in that part of us that is completely hooked into the universal mind, period.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say the word trust. I interviewed Louis Schwartzberg a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you know Louis.
He's great.
Yeah. Amazing cinematographer and director. Yeah. He's made some beautiful films. He has a beautiful film with Jack in it right now called Gratitude Revealed.
Yes, I know.
He talked a lot about nature and trust. And how much within the parentheses or brackets of faith, because I was trying to get at with him, like, what does faith actually mean for you? And he's actually said, well, I spend so much time with nature, and that part of my faith in nature is trust, is I'm going to set up this camera on a year-long time lapse and watch this flower, blossom and expand. And I'm going to spend basically my entire year for 6 seconds of documentary film. I have to have a lot of trust in the foundational intelligence of nature, and I just have to surrender myself to that. And I thought that was just like amazingly beautiful. And it takes faith out of this kind of like, oh, I believe in this bearded yet invisible creator of the universe that has some moral abacus on some mountaintop, like monitoring my sexual transgressions or whatever. the Abrahamic kind of faith.
Yeah.
And this is a very different form of faith, much more as surrender and trust. So that helped me. Anyways.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Oh, I should.
So we got this project coming up. And just to timestamp our conversation today, we're talking in the middle of December at the end of 2022, because I'm sure people will be listening and watching this way into the future, but this is where we are right here, right now, anyways. And in about a month's time, so middle of January, January 16th, I believe, 2023, will be the launch of a great collaboration that we're working on together to bring meditation practice to as many people as will have it, and hopefully more. Certainly celebrating a lot of Ram Dass's work, but as you mentioned, some other friends and luminaries within that
Jack
mix.
And Sharon and Joseph and on. We were talking about music before. And so what this wonderful collaboration is coming to fruition with both visual and music as part of it. So we provided these wonderful meditations from the Be Here Now Network, and Jeff and Commune got some beautiful visuals, and also very importantly, the way that the meditations ride on top of some just wonderful ambient music, because I was checking it out the other day, and it sets you back in your chair in a more relaxed fashion right away. You don't have to think, okay, I better sit up and do this. It's funny how music just relax, you'll be okay. And so this combination, I think, is very powerful, Jeff. And I think people are going to, I mean, it's unique. This is all, even though the meditations, I've been on podcasts that I've done and just stuff from Ram Dass, at the same time, having this combination, as I said, is really quite wonderful. I'm really happy that we're doing this. I think it's going to be of great benefit because it just does make it easier to be with the meditations that are being guided by the various teachers.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I'm so glad that you like it, because obviously you've been around the block as far as meditation programs go. And obviously we're both friends with Mark Watts and Alan Watts' son. We're both admirers of Alan, and he always framed meditation in a way that I really loved. He said, you can often think of meditation as this sort of dismal chore, but if you can reframe it as just grooving with the present, just groove with the present and feel just like no pressure involved. It's such a gift just for, 15, 20 minutes of your day just to groove with the now, That it's as simple as that. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to have all this other kind of
should have, would have, could have,
artifice on top of it. Yeah. And then the benefits will be self-evident. Great. It can relieve you from stress and anxiety. It can increase your heart rate variability. It can certainly be good for your immune system. In fact, dropping your cortisol levels will help you produce more neutrophils, my favorite little innate immune system molecule. And we could go on and on about the development of additional gray matter in the brain and all of these. But these are, again, are sort of happy byproducts of just being in process. And I really think that this program is going to... really going to touch a lot of people, yeah. And for a very, very long time. So yeah, I couldn't be more thrilled than
as you were just describing it, made me think it's just great to sit down and hang out in a space that is not your I got to get up, I got to brush my teeth, I go to the bathroom, I got to have coffee, and then next, the movie of me is what we call, Krishnas calls it, the movie of me. It allows you to cut through that space, which basically is the unending clinging space. And if you just have a few moments, you're going to go off into thoughts and you're going to come back. As Sharon Salzberg says, the beauty of us as humans, you can always go back. You can always return to whatever your focus may be, breath, mantra, whatever it may be. And to allow oneself to be in that space, even just for, if it ends up just being a few minutes, is refreshing, incredibly refreshing.
Yeah,
that should be it. Get refreshed.
That should be it. There's actual clinical research, not to always bring it back to double-blind placebo-controlled clinical trials. But one of the leading indicators for self-reported well-being or happiness is the yoking between your thoughts and your actions or your intentions and what you're actually doing. So much of the time, if you think about it just in one's own personal experience, we're doing something and we're thinking about something else. Well, it turns out that a wandering mind is a patently unhappy mind. And so even if you just take 5, 10, 15 minutes in a day and really try to just align your thoughts with your actions, knowing that you will wander off, but the happiest people are the people that can always continually come back. And it's in some ways, you know, coming back to your breath or coming back to your focus or whatever your particular drishti is or your mantra or your malas or whatever you're using. And there is a great parallel there of always coming back around your own personal journey, because I know that I'm always coming back to the goal of trying to align my works and actions in the world with my highest spiritual principles. And I fall off that more times than anyone could count in a particular day, but you keep coming back. You keep coming back. And that's meditation is an incredible training in that regard. Yeah, so, yeah.
Mayor Baba said, when you fall down and you splash in the mud, you get up and you wipe yourself off and keep going. And that's,
right.
You know, that's the beauty of us as humans. So, great to hang here.
Seven times down, eight times up.
Yeah.
That is life.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm so so grateful to get to know you. I'll be in Ojai in 10 days, so maybe I'll knock if you're there.
Absolutely, yeah. Let me know. Great to be here, Jeff.
All right.
And really happy for this collaboration as well.
Me too. All right. Peace.